The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Melissa Idris, and today with me on The Breakfast Grill, I have Yannis Varoufakis, the former finance minister for Greece. He's also the author of Adults in the Room, My Battle Against Europe's Deep Establishment. Yannis made global headlines in 2015 as the bad boy, leather jacket wearing, motorcycle riding academic who was finance minister for Greece for only 162 days. Well, thank you so much for joining us on The Breakfast Grill today. It's a pleasure having you here, Yannis. I'd like to start with your book, though, Adults in the Room, which is essentially your personal testimony to, of the negotiations with the Troika, the ECB, the EC, the IMF. And they all came up with politically impossible terms for austerity. So this book essentially reads like a spy novel. And I personally can't wait for the movie to be made. But let's come back to what's happening now, because as it is, Greece is set to exit its third bailout in a few months. And for many market observers, this is seen to be somewhat of a symbolic moment, seen as perhaps the end of what has been a decade-long debt crisis. Do you think, Yannis, that this essentially vindicates the Troika?
Not in the slightest. This is nothing more than a piece of propaganda. It's a bit like, you know, renaming your prison cell freedom. But the prison cell remains in every tangible way. Greece is not exiting anything. What is happening is that the money is running out. So the third bailout will be spent by August 2018, and Greece is not going to be receiving any more. Of course, let me condition this on the premise that, of course, Greece never received that money. This is money that is given to Greece so that Greece can use to pretend that it is repaying its unsustainable debt. The true situation is that Greece is now in a permanent debtor's prison, because if you look at the regulations of the European Union, you remain under surveillance, effectively enhanced surveillance. This is like, you know, enhanced interrogation techniques by the CIA, which is, of course, a euphemism for torture. Mm-hmm. Enhanced surveillance means you are still in the Troika's clasps until 2060, at least.
2060?
Yes, absolutely. Because it's only in 2060 that 75% of the loans from the Troika will have been repaid on the basis of overly optimistic projections. Look, it's very, very simple. Let's not complicate matters. In 2010, the Greek state went bankrupt. And the great and the good in Europe and the IMF decided to cover it up, to cover up the bankruptcy. Now, how do you cover up bankruptcy? By means of giving new loans, throwing good money after bad, pretending that the debtor is repaying his or her pre-existing debt. Mm-hmm. Now, not only did they give the largest loan in human history, in absolute terms, not relative terms, to a bankrupt state, but they did this under conditions of austerity that lost us a quarter of our nominal GDP. Mm-hmm. An 80-year-old can understand that this is permanent debt bondage. And then, of course, it's like, you know, using a credit card to repay a mortgage. And then the credit card runs out, and you need a second credit card, and then you need a third credit card. So is this a vindication of the Troika strategy? No. It simply means that the Troika is changing its communication strategy. It's not going to call it a memorandum of understanding anymore. It's going to call it enhanced surveillance. But the fact remains that we have a quadruple bankruptcy in Greece. We have a bankrupt state, bankrupt banks, bankrupt companies, and bankrupt families.
Even though it doesn't vindicate the Troika, Yannis, does that mean that the Troika has learnt at least from the mistakes of the past? Now, in your book, you said it's not about identifying who the good guys and who the bad guys are, but what will be the ethical yardstick then for formulating policy? Do you think the Troika has learned at least from that moving forward?
Yes, they have learned their lesson, except that they're not applying their lesson in practice. If you look at the program they imposed immediately after Greece on Ireland, and then after Ireland on Portugal, and then after Portugal on Spain, and after Spain on Cyprus, they learned their lesson to the extent that they realized that their forecasts regarding growth and recovery for Greece were spectacularly wrong. So they imposed a lot less austerity in every other country they went to. So there was a process of learning on our back. And also, when since you mentioned my book, you were very kind to do so, I mentioned a discussion I had with Christine Lagarde in there, in which she said to me in no uncertain terms that she agrees with my analysis, and I was completely right. But then she added, but Yanis, you've got to understand, we have invested so much political capital in this program, in this kind of failed policy, that we can't go back on it.
This program meaning
the combination of bailout loans with austerity. Okay. Yeah, this toxic combination of irrationality and inhumanity. And so, you know, behind closed doors, they agree. It's clear they've learned their lesson. They've learned that, you know, this really does not work. But they will not come out and say this to you, to journalists, to the public, to voters.
But
and they will keep
you.
Insisting. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it came together with a piece of personal advice for my career, that if I want my career as a politician and finance minister to go well, then I should accept that program. But of course, I was not elected in order to look after my career as a minister, was I?
Well, let's talk about that, because if the people in power in Europe can acknowledge that this perhaps is the root cause, why was there no discussion on that? In the negotiations, you went into great detail into your book, but it was always about the negotiations of the next bailout or the austerity terms. It was never about how we got here and how to fix that.
Well, behind closed doors, we agreed on how we got there. We also agreed on what needs to be done to fix it. But let's face it, politicians and bureaucrats do not like to admit to the public that they were mistaken, especially when that would cost their jobs. So as somebody once said, it's very difficult to convince someone whose job and salary depends on not being convinced. The situation is very simple. In 2010, when Greece went bankrupt, the Chancellor of Germany and the then President of France and his finance minister, who happens to be a lady under the name of Christine Lagarde, and we know what job she has now, they received phone calls from their treasuries and from their banking authorities telling them their main banks were all going to go bankrupt if Greece was going to default on its obligations to them. So, effectively, it was a bailout for four banks, and I'll name them. It was Finance Bank, it was Deutsche Bank, Societe Generale, and BNP Paribas. Two French, two German banks. The money that went to Greece did not go to Greece. It was given to Greece to pass on to those four banks primarily. Yeah? And they came with austerity conditionalities which ensured the collapse of Greek GDP and therefore the impossibility of Greece repaying this money to the taxpayers of Europe that had provided that without having been asked for this. Yeah. So Angela Merkel effectively and Sarkozy and Lagarde in France lied to their parliamentarians. They went to their parliaments and said to them, we need to give the Greeks these huge quantities of money out of solidarity for the Greek people, when in reality they were giving this to their own bankers. And they extracted the consent of their parliaments to do this on the basis of a promise that they would receive every penny back with interest, when they knew that they wouldn't, because when you give a huge amount of money to a bankrupt entity on conditions that shrink their income, you know you're not going to get your money back. So you're asking me, why didn't they move outside the confines of our meetings where they would agree with me
to their
own parliament, to the floor of the parliament, to actually enact changes that would be therapeutic? And the answer is because Angela Merkel did not want to go to her parliamentarians and say to them, I lied to you.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, you said there was, in your words, a cover-up, to cover up the fact that Greece is bankrupt.
It was concealment. It was a toxic concealment of a bankruptcy. We see this all the time. You know, bankers do that. Often when banks have lent a lot of money to companies that have failed, try to cover it up by doing extending and pretending, giving another loan to pretend that the previous one is being serviced. But when you have the largest and most powerful institutions in the world, like the European Central Bank and the IMF, being involved in that, and you're not talking about the company and the bank, but you're talking about whole peoples in Europe, with the impact that that has internationally, you're talking about a much greater problem.
I'm speaking to Yanis Varoufakis, former finance minister for Greece. After this, we're going to continue our conversation about the failures of European integration. So stay tuned to The Breakfast Grill right here on BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Melissa Idris, and today on The Breakfast Grill, Yanis Varoufakis, former finance minister of Greece. He served from January to July of 2015, after which he resigned. For 162 days, Yanis Varoufakis negotiated with the Troika, the ECB, the EC and the IMF on the terms of Greece's austerity. Well, you're here for the World Capital Markets Symposium. It's been discussing the renaissance of capitalism. I'd like to get your thoughts on what you think about this theme, because you have been famously vocal about your quarrel with capitalism. So in your mind, what does this renaissance of capitalism mean? Does it mean a rebirth? Does it mean a regeneration, a renewal of capitalism in today's markets?
It's another piece of communication. It's another piece of propaganda. There's no renaissance of capitalism. Capitalism is entering a deeper phase of crisis. We're still not out of the woods. 2008 is our legacy. You're much younger than me. 2008 is your generation's 1929. And we're still seeing the repercussions of that major financial collapse. I think that there is a lot to worry about, because we have the legacy of that crisis still with us. And we have not dealt with it at a time when the next crisis is hitting us, with the effect of the rise of the machines, the technological innovations and artificial intelligence advances that are going to create serious problems for labor markets, especially in countries that rely on unskilled labor. And I don't necessarily mean Malaysia, also places like the United Kingdom. We have to get our act together, and I'm afraid that our political systems are not doing it.
Why not? Why does it seem like governments and those elected to power don't seem to have the power to effect change?
I think it's institutional change. It's not uniform. I believe that your country is doing, and your government is doing, a much, much, much better job than what American and European politicians are doing. I think that South Korea is doing a far better job. I think that the government of China has been splendid in the way that they have been prescient and efficient in the way they've been managing a very difficult situation, creating bubbles on purpose in order to allow Europe and America a chance to get their act together. But European and American politics is toxic. And let's face it, the European Union is ungovernable. We don't have the institutions. We don't have the federal government that we need to support a common currency area. The United States, that has a federal government, has a constitution that it was written as if designed to cause gridlock. You have a White House and a Congress that are constantly at war with one another for years now, for decades. So this is a spectacular failure of the West. This is a Western crisis, but let's face it, we are in a global system, and that affects you.
Well, you have spoken about this before. The roots of the problems can be traced back to the Washington-Brussels order. What can we in Asia do to move away or learn from the lessons or the failures of that order?
Collaborate far better amongst yourselves in this part of the world. I think that you must resist what's coming from particularly the United States, which is an attempt to ring-fence and isolate China from the rest of Southeast Asia. Asian countries and ASEAN countries must create a lot more trade links, integrate trade between yourselves, create development banks that collaborate with one another and collaborate with the Chinese authorities, and do not allow the toxicity that's coming from the West to prevent the integration of your economies.
Is that how you see Greece moving forward? Because, Greece has been turning to China to stimulate its economy. China's involvement in Greece's economy through investments and influence has been increasing in the past year.
My personal dealings with the Chinese authorities were exemplary. I found them to be patient investors, and investors who were not speculative in their approach. But China does not have the key to unlocking Greece's problems. We are part of a European economy and the European Monetary Union, which is architecturally unsound. We need to mind our own shop in Europe, we Greeks and Italians and Germans, we have to bind together and fix the architecture of our industry, of our monetary system, of our banking systems, of our social systems, so as to be able to collaborate with China in a manner that would be advantageous both to China and to Europe. But it is a European problem. We Europeans have to face up to it.
Do you see China's rising influence as perhaps a threat to...
Not in the slightest.
...to the European Union?
It's the best thing that could have happened to the global economy. China is not imperialistic, at least so far, in the sense of the European and American imperialistic legacies. As I said, they are patient investors, the kind of investors that we lack worldwide, and they would be more than happy for us to get our house in order. Unfortunately, we're not getting our house in order.
Well, let's talk about what it takes to get the house in order, Yanis. Do you think that Europe's mistakes in handling the Greek crisis have continued to shape the limits of Europe today? Because it does foreshadow what's the difficulties that Europe is facing with Brexit, with the migrant crisis, with Catalonia, for instance. Do you think that Greece was the canary in the coal mine?
Absolutely, and I've used that expression myself. The fact that we're still talking about the Greek crisis. Imagine if in the United States, for 10 years, the headlines of the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times was all about how a crisis in the great state of Delaware undermined the stability, both financially and politically and economically, of the United States of America. I submit to you that if that were the case, there would be something wrong, not with the state of Delaware, but with the United States of America. The fact that the European Union has not managed to settle the Greek debt deflationary crisis after so many years is simply indicative of the faulty architecture of our economy, of our governance, the fact that there is no forum in Europe where you're going to have a sensible discussion amongst elected representatives on how to deal with the pan-European crisis which is afflicting all of us. You know, I would go into the Eurogroup, the meeting place of finance ministers of the Eurozone. Never did we have the conversation that we had to have. Like, for instance, you know, what are the deeper causes of the various symptoms of the crisis?
Right.
Instead, we would talk about Irish banks and Greek banks and the Greek debt and this and that, all the symptoms, but we never talked about the causes. So what do you expect? Do you expect a solution to come out of a non-discussion?
Well, who has the Eurozone benefited? I don't know whether there are clear and obvious winners or losers, but in your mind, Yanis...
I think there are. The oligarchies have benefited enormously.
They're the clear winners.
The grasshoppers of the north and the grasshoppers of the south. The bankers of Frankfurt and of Greece did very well out of the crisis at the expense of the peoples of Greece and Germany. If you look at Germany today, for instance, the numbers look fantastic. You've got surpluses everywhere.
Right.
You've got a trade surplus, huge trade surplus, too large. You have a financial surplus, of course, goes hand in hand with the trade surplus. You have a surplus in the federal government. You have a surplus in local government. You have corporations that are in surplus. They're net savers. Now, that sounds fantastic, doesn't it? And yet, there's discontent. Half of the population is feeling that their living standards are worse now than they were 15 years ago. They find that their hospitals and their schools are underfunded. There is very little investment in infrastructure. Now, how can that be? And the answer, of course, is that these surpluses are concentrated so heavily amongst the very few. So 45 families in Germany have 50% of the wealth of the country. 45 families.
45 families,
yes.
Have half the wealth
half
in Germany.
Half of the wealth. So those 45 families have done very well out of this crisis. But what is the purpose of having those surpluses? Because think about it. We can't all have surpluses. If everybody in an economy... Yeah, when I was growing up, I was a long time ago as a young person, I would learn that in capitalism you have households and families saving for the future and firms, corporations, borrowing to invest. Now, if corporations are saving and families are saving and the government is saving, somebody has to have a big deficit. Now, of course, we know who has a big deficit. The periphery of Europe has a big deficit. But at the same time as celebrating your surpluses, you cannot chastise the others for having a deficit. It really makes absolutely no sense. It is clear that the European economy does not have the political institutions that are necessary in order to make it sustainable.
You know, integration is a glorious idea, you know, but do you think it just fundamentally cannot work because nations will look out for their own interests? Are you for integration?
Oh, I'm completely. I'm a Europeanist. I'm a federalist. I want a federal Europe. It's not true that we can't have integration. Think of Germany. Germany in the 19th century didn't exist. It was a very large collection of tiny little states. And, you know, German unification was not a foregone conclusion. Italy did not exist. It was a collection of states. So unifying is absolutely possible and desirable. But to unify, you need political unification. And you need to create a federal democracy as well. We don't have a federal democracy in Europe. We have democracies bound together with intergovernmental mechanisms, which are democracy-free zones. As a committed Democrat, and the reason why I'm a committed Democrat is because I don't believe that society can work. Not even capitalism can work without democracy. During the good times, you don't need democracy. But it's during the bad times where you need it, because while the distribution of profits is easy, the distribution of burdens is difficult, and you need democratic legitimacy and processes that make everyone feel that that they have a say in running their lives during the bad times.
Okay.
So, you know, China will also realize when the plus 6 and 7% growth becomes minus 5 at some point, because this is going to happen, that democratization is an essential part of civilization and sustainability.
Is that your plan for the future, because you're working with the Democracy in Europe movement?
That's right.
Is it 12 countries that are working together, Dennis?
Well, DiEM25, the Democracy in Europe movement, spans the whole of Europe, but we are planning to run in 12 countries.
12 countries.
Simultaneously in the European Parliament elections, the first transnational political party that will demonstrate exactly what you were saying before, the importance and the feasibility of creating a European demos, of creating one country, one people, with all our huge differences. I mean, in this country you have different ethnicities. We want to preserve our cultural differences, but the best way of serving our cultures is to create the federation in which all our cultures can cohabit in a sustainable manner.
Is that a sense you're getting from the ground, that people want this, that they're ready for this?
Yes. But at the same time, they are very disheartened. The failures of the European Union have given a great deal of impetus to the centrifugal forces that are tearing Europe apart and making people say, well, it can't work, so let's go back into the nation state. That retreat to the nation state is not going to deliver them the solace that they seek. It is only a democratization at the European level that might do it.
I do wonder, though, because the conditions are right for rising nationalism, retreating to the nation state, you know, rising populism, everything that comes with deteriorating economic conditions, deepening inequality, rising economic anxiety, perfect breeding ground for rising populism. Is that a concern for you going into elections in 2019?
It's the reason why we do it.
You think you can counter that?
Of course. It is our moral duty. If this was 1930, what would our moral duty be? It would be to reach out across borders and across even political party fixations for all European Democrats to get together to stop the slide into the abyss of the 1930s. That, I think, is exactly what we need to do now. Hopefully we won't have a descent into fascism, although fascism is rising across Europe, and as is racism. It is essential that after our generation's 1929, which happened in 2008, we band together across different countries to carry out that which our grandfathers and grandmothers in 1930 failed to do.
Well, I wish you all the luck.
Thank you. We need it.
I've been speaking to Yanis Varoufakis, former finance minister for Greece. Thank you so much for being on The Breakfast Grill today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Melissa Idris for BFM 89.9, the business station.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.